welcome to Politics and Pedagogy. This is our third episode in our second series, which is focusing on creativity, criticality and care. In this episode, we focus particularly on the care aspect of it, and we're joined by two fantastic feminist scholars.
The first of our fantastic feminist scholars is Roxani Cristalli, who is an assistant professor at the University of St. Andrews School of International Relations. Her research and teaching focus on feminist peace and conflict studies, as well as on the politics of nature and place. A key question animating Roxani's work within and beyond the academy is how people reimagine worlds in the wake of loss. Roxani is the co-principal investigator of a research project on the role of love and care in illuminating richer understandings of loss, politics and place. The work is funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council and the German Research Foundation. For over a decade, Roxani has worked at the intersection of gender and peace building as an academic researcher and humanitarian practitioner, where she regularly advises international organisations and NGOs on gender, justice and peace building. And in conversation with Roxani is a colleague of ours, Dr. Laura Loyola Hernandez, who is a joint senior research fellow and lecturer in human geography at the University of Leeds. Her interests are in decolonial thought, feminist political geography, and critical race studies with a focus on Latin America. Her research and teaching is based on feminist decolonial perspectives, and her British Academy postdoctoral fellowship examined the role emotions have in non-traditional political acts for women to be elected within indigenous communities in Yucatan, Mexico. She has a strong interest in the ways in which critical pedagogies and scholarly activism impact higher education settings, recently finishing a 12-month fellowship at the Leeds Institute for Teaching Excellence with the project Community-Led Pedagogies for Diversifying the Curriculum.
As always, I'm Louise Pears.
And I'm Madeline Labordon. And let's dive into the conversation.
We'll start by thanking you again for making the time to join us on this slightly grey January morning. We're going to be talking about criticality, care and creativity. We'll go straight in with the question about how do you approach a critical pedagogy, or how do you understand that in your own practice?
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you for that lovely introduction, Louise. I suppose there are a few ways that I think about the three C's you've outlined: criticality, care, and creativity. One is that I am increasingly skeptical of being critical for the sake of being critical. I teach a class called Critical Approaches to Peace Building. And one of the first questions the students ask is, critical of what? Critical of whom? And I'm so glad that they ask that, because it's a form of accountability. The answer for me is critical of power. Anytime I teach critical approaches to anything, it comes with a curiosity about how power operates in people's lives. So for me, a critical pedagogy requires being able to see power, name power, analyze power, describe its workings in people, its inequalities, who's leveraging it, and in which way. The second component of that is specificity. I also teach a class on feminist theories and global politics. And in that class, students are very proficient in naming systems of power, systems like patriarchy or white supremacy, talking about racism, talking about colonialism. But a critical approach, a truly earnestly critical approach, requires talking about how patriarchy shows up in daily life. Where do I see patriarchy on a Tuesday morning in the setting that we're analyzing? And I think getting really good at that kind of specificity, not only wielding the label, but having the vocabulary for seeing and naming and analyzing patriarchy on a day-to-day basis, is part of a critical education. And then the final pillar for me, and this really connects to both care and creativity, is that I remind my students and myself that critique is not just about flaw finding, it's about generating visions of worlds. And so we often get, as critical scholars and educators, quite good at deconstructing But the constructing bit, literally, I think the construction metaphors are helpful, is difficult for many. And so the question that I ask myself, that I try to hold myself and my students accountable to, is what sort of worlds are we imagining? If we see the workings of power in all the ways that we hope to, what kind of world are we bringing into being? And so trying to see critique not just as flaw finding, but as world generating, as vision generating, as full of possibility, is some of what I aspire to.
That's fantastic. It makes a really great inspirational start. Lara, do you have a different approach, or what would you add to that?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks so much. It's such a nice way to start the year reflecting on these questions. So thank you so much for the invite. I think for me, I need to take a step back in terms of what critical pedagogy is, because I feel like we're kind of at a moment in time where the material change that Paulo Freire originally thought of with critical pedagogy as a tool of social justice transformation through education has kind of been stripped away almost, and it's become more of a reflective point, almost like whitewashing in a way. And I have to say that I'm guilty of that as well. And it's really been a journey since I started teaching in 2018, being a woman of color, being a migrant, you know, having to navigate academia within that, and having students of color and from marginalized backgrounds that feel like they don't fit in at university, whether because they're first generation, they're from a working class background, they're neurodiverse, or they have like a multitude of intersectional identities. It really has been through that reflection and listening, but also understanding how the university as an institution functions within campus and beyond, that I've understood the limitations of critical pedagogy, where we're at the moment, and understanding that having that care for students and myself as a teacher also is about learning where to push and where to retreat, learning where, you know, I don't want to be in that working group because I know maybe I know that there won't be any material change, but it's important for me to disrupt those spaces because even though I am a minority, I am in a position of power in comparison to my students or maybe someone that doesn't have a permanent contract or doesn't have indefinite leave to remain or like all these type of things. And one of the things that has really helped me in that reflection is creativity. So pushing those boundaries of whether it's the type of stuff that I teach, how I teach it, but also learning from students, like constantly learning from students and hearing that feedback as well. And it's not always like positive, because I think there's like this assumption that students that go to university are very open-minded and liberal and, you know, are kind of in the left spectrum. And that's not necessarily true. And we do have pushback, not only from students, but from colleagues as well. You know, there's a lot of colleagues that don't believe in any decolonization, that's like wokeness and all of that, especially if you're like in STEM or, you know, geography is kind of this weird, funny discipline where we're in, you know, environment, and it leads to interesting conversations as well. So for me, criticality, care, and creativity are all linked. And as Roxane was saying, the context is so important. So where I was in 2018 is not where I am now in terms of my teaching approach, the stuff that I'm teaching, but my own care as well. I mean, I remember when I started, I was so exhausted of like having to push for change, but also preparing my materials and fighting for students. And I'm still exhausted, but I think I've gotten to the point where I understand how care and rest is so important, and we don't apply that enough. I hear myself telling students,
have a rest over the weekend or like make time to rest when you're on break, but then having to tell myself that in a way. So it's learning like the work is always there and it will always be there. It will never end. So it's really important to take the time to rest.
I find that conversation really hard at the end of term when it's coming up to the holidays that we just had, the Christmas holidays we just had. And I'm like, take a break, like relax, but also your deadlines are in January. So it's quite a hard conversation to have with them. I'm like, you can't contact me over the holidays for these dates and these dates, but probably don't, right? Because you should also not be working on those dates. And they're looking at me like, this is a really confused message. But I think, yeah, it's really important.
Yeah, I think it's also something that we ourselves are very bad at doing too. And actually, you know, part of the fact that students get confused is because we're confused about when we stop and start work, and where that ends and where that begins as well.
I mean, just to add to that, I think it's also within the context of like the neoliberal university where you've got to be competitive, you've got to be the best of the best, whether, you know, you're an academic or you're a student, because you want and need to have the best grades to have the best job. And if you're academic, you know, you're constantly like, oh, I need to publish because of ref, or, you know, because of the grant or the promotion. It just like never really stops. Like I often find myself like when I'm in the office, it's like, well, should I take time to just chat with my colleagues and just, you know, maybe go for lunch or whatnot? Or, well, I don't have the time. I have to sit in front of my computer and eat because I've got 5 minutes in between seeing students or getting stuff. So yeah, I think it's part of like the system that we're in that forces you to be in this like constant like merry-go-round.
Yeah, I'm constantly like wondering when I'm going to come off the cycle of feeling like I'm on a precarious contract when I'm not anymore. And that feeling just almost never goes away. It's like a permanent scar that you just start to reflect, like, has the institution done that on purpose, right? That it just kind of creates us to be like that forever because of the way in which it's structured as well. Reflecting on both of your work and what you've just said as well, I think a really important part of the work that you've been doing and the work that you continue to do is around thinking about reflexivity, as you've both touched upon, but the importance of not tokenistic reflexivity, and also holding with that this identity. And I think the work that you did around decoloniality and Who's Uni, Lara, was just so brilliant and such a helpful way in which to see very clearly the way in which identity and one's identity comes so integral to the way in which we maybe practice reflexivity, for example. And also your article, Roxani, on teaching and learning and the reflexivity there. Again, there were so many like mirrors that I could see in both of your works. So I just wondered here, with thinking about identity and that relationality, and how important it is for us to go deeper with identity and reflexivity rather than saying, you know, I am white and I am Western and I am a woman. How do we go beyond that is how I would like to ask you both.
What a great question. Thank you. I have just written about this very dilemma in a piece called Teaching and Learning Reflexivity in the World Politics Classroom, published recently in International Political Sociology. And where that piece came from were the challenges, but also the joys of teaching and learning reflexivity alongside my students, my undergraduate students. And there were a few dilemmas I was really puzzling through. One is that I ask my students to write reflexive responses. Those are 500-word mini essays every week where they connect one idea from the readings to one aspect of their own experience. Those do not have to be intimate, so they could connect a concept from the readings to something in the news or to something they learned in another class. But if they want to make them personal, they can. I just want to offer them a menu of options for engaging with the material that does not force the students to disclose aspects of themselves that they might not want to. And students are, as a general rule, really excited about this kind of engagement with the material. but they're also quite lost, in part because this kind of teaching is not modeled to them early on in their undergraduate education in international relations at St. Andrews, or as far as I'm familiar, elsewhere in the UK system in which I teach. And there are many structural reasons for that, right? And we can talk about that later. But teaching in this way, marking in this way, is very time-consuming and labor-intensive. So I definitely do not want to suggest that the reason students are not being taught this way is because we're lazy or because we're bad teachers. There are all sorts of reasons that are baked into that. And so despite students' excitement, a lot of the early reflexive responses were checkboxing exercises. So I would get the equivalent of, as a privileged white man, I feel. And that's important as a starting point, but not as an ending point, because using the language of privilege doesn't help the reader, the listener, your interlocutor, whoever they are, actually understand what that privilege is. What does privilege shield you from? How does it manifest in your daily life? How does it sit alongside vulnerabilities or liabilities that may or may not be visible? And so I was hoping to push my students towards a practice of reflexivity that goes beyond the adjectives to actually seeing identity in relation to power and in relation to what they're analyzing. And some of how we do that is by modeling good reflexive reading, because it's very hard to produce reflexive writing if you haven't seen the raw materials. And so we read people who do reflexivity well in their own work, people like bell hooks, without necessarily thinking that they're doing reflexivity in quotes loudly in all capital letters. And I think that's so important. So thinking about whom can we read? Who can be a good companion to us as we try to deepen our own practice. And I think it's also important to realize not every reflection has to be about the self. If we're analyzing power, the self will not always be at the center of every conversation. Sometimes it is not about one's femininity or one's status. And so trying to also encourage an outward gaze is part of a pedagogy of care. Trying to broaden reflexivity beyond this idea that the self is the starting and ending point towards a self in the world, in relation to the world, means also knowing when to set that self aside and to turn critical inquiry, curiosity, care, the narrative gaze elsewhere. So that's some of where I have begun. I have a long way to travel. I love seeing change over the course of the semester because this is an iterative exercise. Because students write 500 words every week, it is actually possible and deeply gratifying to see their narratives shift and deepen over the course of the semester. And I love the student-teacher relationship that that kind of writing enables, because the conversations we can have through that writing are really textured and a real gift to behold.
Thank you, Roxani. Laura, it'd be great to hear your reflections there.
There are a couple of different things. My experience is a bit different in terms of when I started teaching, and even within my discipline, talking about decolonization and white privilege and all these type of things is something quite recent. And for me and many others that are minoritized because of structural issues, it's something like deeply personal. It's part of who we are. Like my teaching, what I teach, how I teach, it's so intimately linked to my lived experience of being born and raised in Mexico and what that's meant. And I always integrate like music in my teaching because that's just really important to me. But also, you know, being a really young mom from since I was an undergrad and having to navigate university, being pregnant, and then having another baby doing my PhD as an international student with not being able to take leave, for example, and having to cope with all of that. My partner also being an international student, that has made me aware of quite a lot of things, but also being a parent to two kids who are neurodiverse and having to view the world from their point of view has, as someone that's abled in that way, has also shaped my teaching as I go along. And at times it's been like really frustrating because having to constantly kind of point that out and have that reflection, whether that's coming from students that have severe mental health issues, and has forced me to kind of say, okay, how am I enabling this and how can I change that so it's a more inclusive and supporting environment? And having to see colleagues within and beyond the university that either don't really believe in this or have hopped on the wagon because of career choices, and then, you know, becoming the experts on this or getting grants or getting career promotions. And it doesn't work that way for marginalized staff and students, you know, at times can be really frustrating, but then it's choosing kind of, okay, why am I doing this? So that's like one aspect of it. Another aspect is, and again, I keep coming back to kind of the neoliberal university, because we cannot have these discussions without understanding how this system also produces a particular culture of being overworked, underpaid, completely burned out. So when you want students to have this reflection, and let's say, okay, I want you to write X amount of words at the beginning of the, you know, whether I teach political geography or I teach research methods. And then as you go along, I want you to write, but it doesn't count. It's just, you know, part of the pedagogical exercise. I'm pretty sure most students won't do it, just the ones that are like super engaged. Because, for example, during the pandemic, we kind of did that sort of reflection bit, but students had to record themselves. We asked them a question, and very few students actually did it. Because again, if it doesn't count towards the marks, what's the point, right? Because being in this neoliberal context, it's not about generating a space to reflect, to learn, to really have that time to expand our thinking within this educational space. It's, I'm here for 3 years, I'm paying X amount of money, I only have a short time to get the professional skills I need to get this job. And that's kind of the context from the student's point of view. And then from staff point of view, we have so many students and so much stuff to do that we just don't have the time to have this reflexive approach, because it's like, okay, this is what I need to do. This is how I need to mark. We've got X amount of time allocated to mark each, you know, essay or exam or whatnot. So it's really difficult to navigate within like these neoliberal boundaries, but you can find a way. But I find that it's often particular staff that, like yourselves, that are invested in this and want to do it and want to work with students. And it's almost like the cycle. So when students leave, whether those students have initiated or have these initiatives or have been part of these projects, or when staff leave or are completely burnt out and choose not to do these, then we go kind of back to ground zero. And then, you know, it takes another kind of cycle to start this reflexive, creative care process. And I don't know, I would love to break that cycle, but I just don't know how. I think a lot of it is also archiving the work that has been done from decades ago and learning from that. But that also involves work. So I guess for me, the big thing is, how can we break that cycle so we aren't dependent on individuals, but actually almost like hack the system in a way, as Le Peperson writes in The Third University. It's a really small book, which is amazing if you've not read it. And they argue that the university is part of a system, and they take on Donna Haraway's work. I've actually written an article that hopefully will come out soon on this, but they talk about how we need to hack the system, and how we hack the system is through these Skyboard connections, right? Because even though students leave, you've made that connection that hopefully will have that impact in their lives. So whether they go on to civil service or private sector or whatever, they're then kind of penetrating that system that's also interconnected with the university system. So I have actually found that really helpful in not feeling so despair, but actually saying, okay, it's about making these tiny connections. And if we all make these tiny connections along the way, we are almost like hacking these systems that are all interconnected. So I found that quite useful, actually.
Yeah, I love that. I think trying to write something about scholarship communities. And I think one of the things is that I felt really supported, and people are really generous with their time. Right, this podcast is a really good example of it. We've often asked people to have conversations and they make time to do it. And so trying to move away from seeing everything as like, you have to do it. And also it's your domain because you're competitive, right? So this is my thing. This is my thing. And actually, like, if we share those things and have those connections, how that can be generative. So I like that idea of small connections as being one of the way that we can, yeah, hack the system.
Also, what you just said there, Lara, was just, there's so much in it, because it speaks as well to two conversations that we already had on the podcast. And I just think as we do this podcast, there's just so many links through what we've been talking about in each episode. But with Ida and Alex in our first episode of this season, we were talking about, you know, like, can there be care within a neoliberal institution? Like, how do we do that? Like, care can't exist here. And actually, what you're saying there is that there is a way, and it is about these kind of small connections that we can make as well. I think often, as you said as well, it puts a lot of pressure on individuals and certain individuals to do that, and often minoritized individuals to do that as well. And I think that that's a really important point. And you also talked about that idea almost of like archiving, and it really reminds me of the conversation we had with Rob Ishilliam, and he was talking about cultivation of knowledge, and that there's so much already there, but because we work within this neoliberal institution, it's always about more, rather than what is already here and what are we ignoring or what is being silenced. Yeah, I just think there was just so much from that, and it's so wonderful to learn from you both as well with this too.
Just to add to that, Madeline, so La Pepperson also wrote a paper with Eve Tuck. So La Pepperson's other name is Wang. So they wrote the decolonizing is not a metaphor. And they've got another article where they talk about the politics of to refuse and the politics to refuse coding, especially I think for those of us who have now kind of immersed ourselves in research with students and around pedagogical practices. There's a lot of ethics and ethics of care that need to go into that, especially when we're working alongside students that are from like marginalized backgrounds. And I found that piece very empowering, because basically the short message of it is to refuse to code certain conversations or emails or talks that you have with students or colleagues that, you know, some stories are just for us and are not for the institution and are not for our career or for that article, and navigating kind of that fine line of, okay, you know, and students have talked about this. It's important to shed a light on these things, whether it's about inclusive practices revolving, you know, students from religious backgrounds or, you know, that are neurodiverse. But yeah, also kind of refusing to give the institution those stories in a way and not reproduce this trauma porn almost of why should we do this? Why should we invest in mental health for students? And it's like, well, I'm not, you know why. I'm not going to give you another story so that, you know, you can feel good about doing this or that. So yeah, I found that piece really important and empowering, because it kind of almost takes away the temptation of, okay, what story should I put on those pieces of paper? What story should I talk about with upper management and what stories are just between students and I in a way, if that makes sense.
So much sense that I just wrote down the sentence, some stories are just for us and not the institution, because I just think that that's such a brilliant line and just so important, because we talk about this in research all the time. Why are we not talking about it within our classrooms as well? Thank you. So our next question was, how do you introduce care in your teaching and work? And I guess you've really started that boundary setting, I guess, in one idea. But is there anything else that comes to mind when you're thinking about care in your teaching and learning?
Can I just jump in? I think you might be about to bring this up, Roxanne, but I remember you speaking about the introduction of joy into classrooms as well. And I'd love to hear you kind of explain that, because I do a really bad version of explaining. I'm like, oh no, this is amazing. And then I can never quite articulate it. But it's just one thing that I'd be really interested to hear a bit about.
Thank you. I don't mind being nudged down the route of joy. I think we could use more of that kind of nudging. So a few starting points for me. One is that I don't have to introduce care to the classroom. It's already there. And I think if we acknowledge care as a daily practice that enables life and living to go on, as opposed to just as a theoretical vector or as a pedagogy, then we will actually begin to see it everywhere. So the question for me becomes, how do I open myself up? How do I foster? How do I cultivate the care that there already is? How do I encourage something that's already there? And I think that sometimes means being open to reciprocity as well, and acknowledging that students can care for us. I think very often conversations about care in the classroom frame care as an obligation that educators have towards our students. And we do, right? We have a duty of care, and many of us embrace caring pedagogies. But I think it can be quite exhausting to think of care as yet another thing we have to do and do well, that we ourselves do alone. So I think thinking through the lens of reciprocity and what are the ways that students care for each other, not just we care for them. What are the ways that students care for us by practicing curiosity about our lives, by just being gentle humans in the way that humans can be? For me, it makes the whole task less exhausting. The second way I think about care is as not only pertaining to humans and our relationships to each other, but also to our broader environments. I teach a class on the politics of nature and place. And so I think a lot about what does it mean to care for the place at which our education unfolds, which many of us call home for however long or short a period of time we each happen to live here. And I think, again, framing care outwardly as pertaining to more than humans, as pertaining to the sea that surrounds us in St. Andrews, to the birds, to the plants, actually links care and attention, care and noticing, in ways that I find really moving. And so for me, care in the classroom also means sharing with students, what are the birds that are migrating over the North Sea where we learn, if we're talking about the politics of nature and place? And what are ways that we can know those birds, not only through their decline, through their extinction, through the loss and destruction of their habitats, through climate change, but also through their habits of living? What are the ways we can practice noticing the soil, noticing the trees, noticing birdsong, noticing what the air feels like? And I think all of that can be part of a practice of care. On 1 week of the politics of nature and place, my students keep care diaries where they document what is the care that they practiced and what is the care that they received. And we look at those critically and reflectively together, almost as a coding exercise. And we think, what didn't you document? Did you write down that you felt cared for on a walk by the sea? Why is it that we might have forgotten to think that the sea practices care as well, albeit with different ideas of agency than humans might? And so we look at those unevennesses and silences as well. And the last thing on Louise's prompt on joy, I teach on quite heavy subjects at times, as many of us do. I teach about patriarchy, I teach about violence, I teach about climate change, and there is so much to be gloomy about. And I think it is important to be clear-eyed about the gloominess, to know how to name it, to know how to carry it. And alongside that, I'm very interested in the question of what sustains life, what enables people, communities, social movements to go on in the face of such tremendous loss, violence, suffering, and overall gloominess. And often what sustains life are care and joy. When you ask people what got you through the week, very few people will say, well, the faculty meeting is what got me through the week, or the committee meeting I went to. But they'll often talk about what is it that filled them right up. And so I like to start student discussions by tuning our attentiveness towards joy. So what brought you joy this week? And in the beginning, students are often bewildered by the question, perhaps because they didn't expect to have it asked in a seminar on violence or peace or feminism or climate change. And perhaps because it's not a question we ask very often. I don't want joy to be a duty for them. I don't want it to be another thing that is on their list. I just want them to know that there is a responsible adult who week in and week out will inquire about joy. Because what I find is that if you inquire about joy, people become attuned to it and people report back on it. And I think learning what it is that sustains us, that enables us to do the work we want to do in the world, that enables us to live in the kinds of relation we want to have, as Laura really beautifully said earlier, I think is how we survive, not in service of the work, but in service of thriving and community and all the other selves we want to be and things we want to do in the world.
Thank you. That's such an uplifting way of looking at the way in which we do our teaching and learning. And I'm really fascinated by your module there on nature as well. It really reminds me of some work that had been done at a Spear at Queen Mary by Julia Carabelli and Joanne Yeo, which is, again, they have a space in the local community where they're thinking about the module is about environment, environmental futures, but there they're getting the students to care with plants and think about the environment with plants. And I just think that's such a beautiful way in which to get students to connect with nature and the environment around them as well.
Absolutely. And again, it takes us outside of ourselves. I can't teach about nature if I don't teach with it, right? And Kathy Elliott is another wonderful colleague at the UCL Center for Pedagogy who teaches the sister class to mine, also called The Politics of Nature. And she and I think a lot about how do we get students outside? How do we tune their noticing to destruction and extraction? Yes. And also, how do we get them to practice care towards plants and soil in ways that they might not have thought come with the politics or international relations education?
Laura, be great to hear your reflections.
I think care and joy was one of the things that came most about in the project that I did with students that resulted in the Who's Uni poster that I did. And it just became so apparent the importance of not only caring for one another, but also reminding us of that care. So if you see, for example, in the poster, so first of all, it's a huge picnic, right? Because I really wanted to center food, because food is so important and it's such a, you know, it's the basis of care and joy. And you also can't learn and teach if you're hungry. And we can't shy away from the fact that we do have students and staff, and increasingly more and more and more with the cost of living crisis that we currently are experiencing in the UK, but also in other parts of the world, that we do have staff and students that are going to food banks, that are hungry, that can't afford a meal on campus. And this is something that did come up in the research that I did with students, but also being on the picket line over the past 5 years and really listening to colleagues that have been very open about that. So first of all, yeah, you can't have these discussions, even about working and teaching and learning within the university, when you don't address food. So for me, it was really important to center food, but also, you know, food for me represents community, it represents joy, it represents who you are and where you come from and where you want to be. So the Who's Uni poster is in a picnic, and the idea was to represent people coming together, whether that's bringing something from home. But in one of the drawings in the poster, where you can get on the live website at Leeds, is, you know, someone saying, have you had a drink? And then the other person responds, oh, you caught me. I haven't had anything to drink all day long. And that's so true. Like my partner, for example, they have to commute to another city. And sometimes we teach all day long and we literally have no time to eat or drink. And reminding each other, hey, have you had time to have a glass of water? Have you had something to eat? Do you want anything? So I think, first of all, that's like so important. But then how do you promote that care? I've done it in some really small, obvious ways. So whether that's when you're writing emails to students saying, hey, you know, the material for our next class is now available. Please enjoy your weekend. Rest. You know, when they're in assignments, you know, I write and say, remember to drink water. Remember to eat. Like if you need anything, please get in touch with me. You know, ask and take care of each other as well with your friends. And it might seem like super obvious, but I feel like we don't state the obvious in an explicit way. And it's so important to do that. But also, if you see colleagues that are struggling, that are resting, saying, hey, do you need me to cover for you? Like, what can I do? And I know I won't get any recognition for that, but I don't do it because of that. I would love to be in a working environment where that is the norm, because that helps. But in more concrete ways, and as a result of that, for example, that research project that I did with students, we've implemented some pilot activities in my school. So one of the first things that we did is called a community shelf. So we have a reception in geography, and I've brought in secondhand board games, puzzles that I've bought in charity shops, and also have asked staff to bring stuff that they don't want to. And the idea is, yeah, for anyone to kind of take something, have a go at it, and just create this environment where, you know, they could just relax or engage in conversations that are outside the teaching and work environment. So that's like one thing. I don't know if it helps or not, but I think it's just like having it there. Another thing is, over the next month or so, we're going to launch what I've called a community pantry. So as an experiment to address the food poverty that is going on. So the idea is to have a small, non-perishable food pantry open maybe 2 hours a week, and then have also staff donate. And basically anyone from the school can come in, bring donations, but also take donations. And there's also stuff that has also been started to be implemented, especially by our head of school and our school administrator, who have really taken this initiative on board, like trying to create a community within the school. And it's really made a difference. And I really want to recognize their work as well. So whether that's having sanitary products in bathrooms to address, you know, period poverty. We've got plants now as well. We've got a sense of belonging team, and we've done a couple of events. So Liam, who's a great colleague in the school, did a GIS fest. So that brought in quite a lot of students. For Christmas, we had a plant propagating initiative. So we had staff and students help out so they could take the plants to the house or for the school. And We had Christmas stuff as well. I also run the Black and Student of Color Forum, and I'm going to expand it more to have people, or like students mostly, that don't feel like they belong in geography. And there's a plan to do a walk through the Yorkshire Dales in early spring, and, you know, just bits and pieces as well. But I think it's also important to talk about care and joy outside of work, and to also not give up the things that we like to do and not feel guilty about that. So whether that's watching really trashy TV, or whether that's training for a run or knitting or having friends over, I think it's so important that we do that. And for me, having kids really brings that into perspective, because they don't care that I work. They don't care if I need to publish. And like, they will say, oh, you're really grumpy because you've been at work. And that's like, oh, it's like, okay, it's a wake up call in that sense. So that for me has really been what centers me as well.
That was really good. We tried, it's an idea we borrowed from, I think sociology did it, to have a breakfast for students, and it's just like for 2 hours, and it's served in the building as well. It's so hard to say why they felt so good, but they just felt so good to do them. Even I think that they existed for people who didn't go. It just is like, well, isn't this a great thing that this exists? And staff and students are kind of mixed. We separated out undergraduates and postgraduates, but that felt like one of those little gestures. And again, it was something about it being built around food. And when I was looking at your poster, Lara, there's someone saying like, oh, I've never tried this before. And when we had it with the postgraduates, I had some Chinese students, and one of them was like asking, is this kind of typical English breakfast food that you have served? And I was like, no, this is more your, like, it was kind of nice thing. So it was like, I was like, no, we would have like fried meat products if it was truly English. And it was just really nice. And I think I really like all of those little suggestions. And I think there's ways that we could maybe bring them into our school and borrow some of those ideas as well. And that'd be really good. So then we're approaching the end, but the final theme that we might want to speak about more specifically is the idea of creativity, or creative practices you've tried, or creative practices you've seen that you think have helped.
I love the more wacky and creative people are in their teaching practices, but also in like their assessments, the better. So whether that's design, a podcast. In Leeds, we've got a new room called the Helix Room, and it has like podcasts, and it's free, like students and staff can use it. It has like Legos. It's like a proper studio as well for recording. It has virtual reality stuff. And I think thinking outside of the box in that sense, and in my experience, it's what students like in a way. But again, it's so difficult because everything is standardized. So it's not like, oh, I want to do this. You know, I want to do a zine, and then I want to do an exhibition, or students need to do like a poster and present it and stuff like that. There's so many things having to go through, you know, departmental meetings, faculty, quality assurance, university, discipline. Like, there's so many standards that it becomes really difficult to be able to be creative. That's one element of it. But also we go back to, it's not the same to have a class of 20 to have a class of almost 200. And unfortunately, it's really difficult to be able, it's not impossible. And I go back to the work of my wonderful colleague, Liam Taylor, who's in geography, who's doing some really creative, inspiring stuff. And for example, he started an Instagram page for one of his classes, and it's just really great and fun as well. And the students interact. But I just kept thinking, oh my God, but then who has to do that? And like the posting and like the check-in, that's a lot of responsibility. So I think, yeah, I mean, it's great, but we have to kind of think of the reality of what people face in terms of, okay, I can't for the life of me check 200 zines or 200 podcasts. But then you also have to think of accessibility and inclusivity issues as well. Again, there's an increase in mental health issues with students and staff as well. So not everyone is able to do group work or go out and do field trip because maybe they can't afford it, or because of mental health issues, or they just don't feel comfortable being from like a marginalized background. Like in geography, we have field trips as well. And students, especially from working class backgrounds, have never gone out for a hike, for example, so don't feel comfortable. Or we've got commuter or mature students. You know, we do have students that have been formerly incarcerated and kind of what that also implies. So being creative in how we teach and how we approach assessment is really important, but it's also really challenging because you have all these kind of multiple things that you need to consider, that it's really, really difficult. And I think a lot of it is making those connections. So for example, I didn't know that Polis and Sociology have these breakfasts for students, which sounds amazing. And there's a lot of these like tiny initiatives going around that we just don't know about it because we don't hear about them. They're not promoted, or they're very like in the very niche. So I think it's about getting those initiatives out there, learning from each other, but in a non-competitive way, right? Because we've got all these awards going on in universities and teaching awards and all of that. And while it's great that people are recognized for their hard work, they're also political as well, in a sense. So it's, again, finding that balance of how can we promote working together, in being in community together in a non-competitive way.
I couldn't agree more, Laura. As you were speaking, I said yes silently on mute several times. I think every so often there's an adjective that makes the rounds in higher education, and it usually comes with work. Like innovative is another one, right? Like innovative teaching, creative teaching. And so if listeners are groaning right now and thinking, oh God, not another thing, I am with you. I think sometimes it is enough to do the job to the best of your conscience with as much care as you can muster, to set down the things that you feel you're not able to carry. And that's great. You're doing great. And so I think that's a really important starting point, that creativity should not be another sprinkle on top of everything we do, often unpaid, unrecognized, and with the very last bits of fatigue that we can drudge up from inside ourselves. I think being moved to do what speaks to us is sometimes enough. The other way I think about creativity, and again, this really builds on something Laura said earlier, is not all of that has to happen in the classroom or in the university. I garden, I love gardening. And people often say to me, why don't you write an article about gardening? And it's like, I don't want to write an article about gardening. I want to garden. Those are fundamentally different activities, which is not to say that there aren't great articles to be written about gardening. Several people have written them. But that is not the direction in which I want my creativity to go. So also learning what not to monetize or professionalize, and to just enjoy it, to be a little bit bad at it or not care if you're good or bad at it. For me, that is much more freeing than writing an article about gardening would be. And then the other way I think about it, and again, it builds on what Laura was saying about how not all students can or want to engage with this material, is I try to create little ramps off the classroom in creative ways, but also within it. So I teach a lot with poetry. I don't teach about poetry, I teach with it. And if you're interested in the distinction, I've written about it for the British International Studies Association in an article on gathering in vulnerable times. And my students sometimes get very anxious where they want to like poetry, but they're not sure they get it or that they're good at poetry, and they're not in a school of English or an English department, they're in a politics and international relations department. And so I make it very clear to them, the poetry is an offering that I make to them because it speaks to me, because it moves me, because it enables and sustains life, as I was saying earlier. It is not something they have to engage with or like or write. It's a way of saying, I will meet you there if this is what you're interested in. And if this is what you're interested in, here are ways that you too can engage with poetry or with gardening in your life, not necessarily in the scheme of this particular class or in the university. And so seeing them as little ramps, almost like exits off a highway that people can take if they want to, if they have the energy, if they're moved by it, but also giving them permission not to, for me, allows me to frame creativity more as an offering than an obligation. I have very little room in my life for more obligation. And I have all the room in the world for offerings that we make to each other. And so that's the direction in which I'd like to move.
Thank you for that, Roxani, because when I hear the word creativity, I often feel quite anxious because I'm not a naturally creative person. That's just not me. And therefore, when I'm thinking about that within my teaching, I almost feel like, oh my God, it's more work. This isn't what I'm good at. But I love giving ramps. Like, my work is always in informal educational spaces. So spaces in the everyday where we're learning about global challenges. And I think I give ramps, but I've never thought of it as a ramp before. So just thank you for providing that language. You know, this conversation has been so brilliant because it's not about giving us more work. It's almost like acknowledging the work we do and taking that pressure off ourselves, that it doesn't have to be a product, it can just be as well.
I think you do yourself a disservice, Madeline. I think your karaoke is very creative.
I am very creative. Karaoke, that's very true.
Yeah. Well, I think as well, Lara, we used your report as a thing to think about in a workshop, and you had a music playlist. And that was a really good, that was exactly that, where it was like an offering, and it just made me think about it in a really different way. And it was a really nice thing to see in the middle of a report to be like, take a break, listen to some music.
Anything that tells me to listen to Lauryn Hill, I'm here for.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons is I didn't want the report in itself to kind of feed into this diversity and inclusion capitalist type of, okay, this is a report, I've consumed it really fast and not had time to reflect. These are the solutions, let's move on. So one of the reasons why those comfort breaks are spread out throughout the report is that it was important for me for the reader to stop, but also to bring back that bit of joy that we were talking about as well. So there's like a playlist, as you say, there's like a recipe to prepare, a food recipe. And at the end, we end with a self activity. So whether that's like biking or whatnot. And I mean, I don't know if people did it or not, but it was, yeah, important to produce that report with those comfort breaks as well.
We did it. We put the music on in between.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, great. I'm aware that we are over an hour now of your time, so we'll bring it to a close. I want to give you opportunity if there's anything you wanted to mention or flag that we haven't had chance to talk about. But I think, yeah, if we use some of the language of the thing, I think I found that very enriching and joyful and sustaining, and it's been lovely, great way to get back into work.
What a gorgeous way to start January. So thank you. I don't know, I just feel very nourished in that conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, no, thank you, because this is also like a really great opportunity to reflect and what we've done and where we want to be, especially at the beginning of the year and term. So thank you so much, it was really nice.
That was absolutely fantastic. As came up a bit in conversation, that was recorded on quite a dark day in January, but definitely brightened our spirit, and Madeline and I have gone on to have conversations about it ever since.
Yep, that has definitely been my Roman Empire, and I will be thinking about that for a while. Thank you so much to Roxani and Laura.
And thanks, listeners.